Okay.
Would you prefer we share the publisher link or the Amazon link?
Publisher link, I think.
Okay. All right. I'm going to make a
only in the only sense that in that case, Jeff Bezos doesn't get as much money.
I'm okay with that. Hold on, let me speak it out. Welcome to our next episode of NIACast, everyone. This is Mana Mostatavi, joined by Dr. Asal Rad and the great Ambassador John Lindbergh to discuss his newest book, Believers, Love and Death in Tehran. Ambassador Lindbergh is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran and the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. He is a veteran U.S. diplomat and a former official at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, where he was held captive during the Iran hostage crisis. And, of course, Ambassador Lindbergh is a board member at NIAC, so welcome.
Thank you, and greetings to all NIAC friends and colleagues.
Thank you for joining us, Ambassador Lindbergh. I just want to give a brief summary of the book. So it's a fascinating spy novel set in Iran in the years following the revolution. And through the book's central character and protagonist, Niloufar, we get an inside view of political complexities and intrigues on both the Iranian and American side. And while the story really begins with the U.S. embassy seizure of November 1979 and the crisis that ensues, it covers a longer timeline into 1980s Iran and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. And what I really liked about it is while it has all of this context and grounding, it comes back to the present and provides us a look into really our current political context. So looking at that, the first thing that I wanted to ask was, you know, this is obviously a fictional book. And there's a note at the very beginning that says this is fiction. You know, all the names, all these things are fictional. But it's based on this very real historical context. And I thought, could you tease out for us just a little bit how much of it, you know, is fact and how much of it is fiction, in the sense that as a reader, maybe someone who's not as familiar with the history, what do you think they should take as the historical part that is actually accurate, and then what is, you know, sort of the creative liberty that's being given to the book?
Well, I should say first of all, Asal, thank you for your question, and thank you for your kind words about the book as well. Let me also mention that my co-author, Ambassador Mark Grossman, unfortunately is not able to be with us today, but he came up with the idea originally and came to me about two years ago and said, what if someone, there had been a foreign service officer who was in Tehran but was not captured on November 4th, 1979. Do you think we have a story from that? Do we have a novel? And I said, of course we do. And I also said to him, where have you been all these years? Because this was a story waiting to be written, I think, waiting to be written. And from there, we built the story around two main protagonists, Niloufar Hartman, who is an Iranian-American woman, a young foreign service officer. And she arrives in Tehran the night before the embassy is taken over, or actually early in the morning of that morning, and spends the night at her Iranian mother's family's house. And before she can go into work the next day, she learns that the embassy has been attacked and the staff captured. She was originally sent to Iran by a very senior State Department officer, Alan Porter, who canceled her original assignment, her original first assignment, which was to go as a visa officer to Kingston, Jamaica. And he looked at this and said, this makes no sense. Iran is in chaos. We need somebody there like Niloufar. There are 30, 40,000 people waiting for visas at the embassy. They need help. So he asks her to go, and it's orders her to go. And she goes. And when this happens, and when it becomes clear that the embassy staff is not going to be freed anytime soon, because Ayatollah Khomeini has, who is really the only person with the power to stop that, to resolve this crisis, has endorsed the takeover. And at that point, Porter says, oh my God, now we don't know, we need to know what's going on in Iran. We have nobody there. We're blind. And he asks her or orders her to stay in Iran and be his eyes and ears. And that's really the first and second parts of the story. And she, but the story is fiction. Now, the problem is that a lot of readers don't, you know, are not of our age. I mean, they don't remember these events. And so it's difficult sometimes to separate the fact from the fact from the fiction. But that's what a good historical novel does. If you're familiar with the books of Hilary Mantel or Robert Graves, these are very much fiction, but based on history, based on what happened, so that there are real historical figures in here, and we include in the book a chronology of real-world events. So we have her, for example, involved in Iran-Contra, in the middle of Iran-Contra, and we have her in some interesting conversations with people involved on the Iranian side of Iran-Contra. We made these up. We made up the conversations, and we put her there the same way some of the things are related to the hostage crisis, to the civil strife that was going on in Iran, the political battles that were going on in Iran, to what happened in Halabja in March of 1988. We made her a kind of Forrest Gump character, if you're familiar with Forrest Gump, who was always in the middle of, it was this fictional character, but always there when something was happening. The present, the part about the part happening in the present, that is, again, completely made up. We made up the groups. We made up the names of the various, you know, all the people. We made up the the situations, and we made up the. In the book, there are messages. She ends up staying in Iran, and she ends up staying for 8 years, doing different. They're working in Ayatollah Beheshti's office, working in Hashemi Rafsanjani's office, 3 years. As a member of the morals police. And this was really fun to write because if you think of, you know, what would be the most unlikely place to look for an American spy in Iran in the 1980s, it would be the Gash, the morals police. I mean, these people were the, you know, considered by many to be the dregs of society, the most brutal, the most difficult, the most arrogant, and that's what she does. That's what she does because that's her way of carrying out her mission. That's the way she carries out her mission. So she ends up staying in Iran in 8 years through all of these events. So we put her in. We said, okay, if she had been in Hashemi Rafsanjani's office at the time they were talking about Iran-Contra, what would have happened? And that's where writing a book like this is so much fun. You know, if there had been an undersecretary in Washington who was working with her, what would he have said? What would he have asked her? How would he have helped her? What would the relationship have been? And as any novelist does, you draw on your experience. You draw on what you know. For example, there's a reference in there to Moby Dick, which we all know in Washington as the kebab place. But in pre-revolutionary Tehran, it was a very upscale sandwich shop, which was very popular, I'm told, among students at Alborz College, the famous Alborz College. So these are the kinds of things that, you know, that you do. And the fun part, I should say, this thing was fun to write. Really,
it seems that way.
because
it's fun to read. I would assume it would be fun to write.
I hope it was fun to read. Because you know, if all the things you know, the things that we knew about Washington, the things we knew about Iran. I mean, parts of it are very painful, but you know, some of the events are very painful. But if using what we know and then taking this character and the other characters. And putting them into those situations is a way. It's a lot more fun, I find, than writing a straight history.
I agree. Well, you know, we're talking about the characters, and so actually, what I found most fascinating is that this book was written from the point of view of a woman, and in a favorable way, really explores the role of the women, you know, both in the Iranian Revolution, but also in the U.S. Foreign Service. And I think one of my favorite lines in the novel was, "If the women were running Iran, we wouldn't be in the mess we are." So I guess my question is, what propelled you to want to write it from the point of view of a female?
That's a good question. That's a good question. As soon as we started, we almost immediately said the hero has to be a woman. And I think it comes from different sources. I mean, you know, you ask any author, what are the sources of your inspiration? Why did you do this? I think it came from experience of some very strong Iranian women. We've dealt, and you'll see that the characters on the Iranian side, not only Niloufar, but her mother Farzaneh, her friend Nazanin, and others, are very strong very resilient kinds of people. That's an experience from my Iranian family. Perhaps it is. Does my daughter recognize herself in Niloufar? Perhaps she does. I don't know. But these are obviously sources of inspiration. Ambassador Grossman himself is the father of a very strong daughter. It was a woman, and this is just, you know, this is experience.
I think it was the reason that immediately popped out to me was there were two parts. One was, despite, you know, you said that these women are strong and you preserve their sense of agency despite sort of being barked at by men the entire time. You know, there's this line that comes up over and over again where this is not really a request, it's an order, but it doesn't take the agency from the women, which is what I really appreciated. And I think actually the reason I was sort of like taken aback, like pleasantly taken aback that this was written from the point of view of a woman is because I did a book review for Shirin Ebadi back in the day, maybe 10 years ago, about the Golden Cage. And it was written from the perspective, the Golden Cage. So it was also sort of a historical fiction about the revolution, but it only followed the stories of three men, three brothers.
Oh, okay.
And so to read sort of, you know, a similar take in a way from a woman was just incredibly refreshing. So as an Iranian woman, I would like to say thank you for that.
Well, I mean, you know, why is it, you know, you look at Iran today, and when I said that if the women were in charge, this would not be the mess that it is. That was from the heart.
You know, I tend to agree.
we're a little biased potentially, but we did definitely agree with that sentiment. And I would say, you know, and I also very much appreciated that it was so many of the central characters were female and really driving the story. And as Mona pointed out, with their agency, I think that's missing not only in all of our sort of histories, right? Like the way that histories are told very often is with male protagonists, is with like the history of great men, as they like to call it. And so it was nice to have a perspective, whether it was fictionalized or not, but where women were central to that history, because especially in the case of Iran and the revolution, women were absolutely central to that. And it was interesting because in the novel, when you're depicting the Iranian figures, such as Beheshti, they are cognizant of that fact. You know, they're very much playing into that fact. There's one part where Beheshti goes to, you know, a group of women. And that's basically the point that he's trying to make, is we can't have this revolution without the women. We can't, you know, you are our sisters in this fight. And that kind of mentality was very much true of the revolution and everything that's happened afterwards, but is often missing from the storytelling, and especially in the contemporary politics. I feel like you don't see women that much. So it was nice to have that.
That we were very concerned. We were very concerned that we catch what I would call the vibe of both Tehran and Washington in those days. And I hope we've done so. So what if we have, I'm very gratified.
Yeah, that's great. Sort of pivoting a tiny bit. I wanted to touch on the. You know, there's part of the story where you describe the American shootdown of the Iranian passenger plane in 1988, which I'm sure you know is kind of a sensitive topic for many Iranians, and probably more so today because of the January shootdown of the Ukrainian airline. Can you tell us a little bit sort of about the distribution of blame in the retelling? Because I think it suggests that it partially occurred as a result of an IRGC inside job. And so that we, you know, Asa and I talked about that. And we're like, let's just ask Ambassador Lindbergh.
No, yeah. That's pure fiction. But we were told by a very experienced author who read generously among the friends who very generously read early versions of this manuscript that we needed... We needed more villainy. We need that. It's villains that sell books. Think of James Bond. I mean, who do you remember? Dr. No, Goldfinger, you know, Smursh characters, Eva, that woman in Doctor. I mean, it's villains that sell books. So we took our main villain and built up his character. And made him responsible for this, partially responsible for these events. But that's fiction. That's completely made up. So I hope nobody takes that one literally, because we wanted to relate it to the tragedy that occurred at the end of the second part of the novel.
Oh, that's so interesting the way that you say it. So that part of it is fictional, but to sort of play up this notion, obviously in a novel to have a villain absolutely makes sense, because it's interesting where I think in a lot of the novel where you're presenting these political complexities, there are clearly things that are happening that are atrocities. You know, I mean, you're describing atrocities that happen at the hands of the Islamic Republic. But there's also sort of a distribution of blame there where it's the U.S. facilitating that happening, or where you have the case of when we're covering the Iran-Iraq war, you know, the atrocities at the hands of Saddam. But it seems like, and I really liked this, that there wasn't an attempt to sort of just paint one side as this is the villain and this is the good guy. But it was, look, this is how complex these political situations are. There are these horrible things happening. Innocent people are suffering. But there are so many complexities and characters that are facilitating these things to happening. So it was interesting to see that in the fictionalized part of the story, you try to create a sort of clear villain. Like, this is the bad guy. We're supposed to not like this character, and obviously you don't, because what he does is horrific to the characters that you grow to care about.
Right. Exactly. But the others are complex. I mean, as Niloufar realizes that she has blood on her hands, that she's been involved in a lot of misery, that she's responsible for a lot of misery. Now, maybe you don't like the groups that are being suppressed, maybe you oppose them, but that doesn't, you know, that in her mind, that does not justify the extent of what was done to these people, how many were murdered, imprisoned, tortured, forced into exile, and all of these things. And there's where she has her, without giving away the story, this is where she has, her big crisis, mm-hmm. And basically tells and sort of stands up to Porter. I mean, up until that time, she's been the, you know, the very obedient young Foreign Service officer. And when he tells her to do something, she does it, because that's the psychology. That's the those are the values that she has of the organization that she's part of. But and at one point she says, I can't do this anymore. We have to stop. We have to stop this, because this has gotten out of this has gotten out of control. And she never stops. She never forgets that, you know, even down to the present day, when she has to go back. And she said, how can I go back there when I did so much misery? How can I face my family? There's a part in there, I hope this rings true to you, where she said, you know what I appreciated is that my family never asked what I did. They never judged me for what I did, for what I did. And she said, you know, she said that that's what saved, that's what in the end saved me.
And I like, you know, I don't, to your point, I don't want to give away any of the story, but there's, you know, an Iranian counterpart, I think, in that, in the character of Nazanin, where I think Nazanin has, even though she's a peripheral character, she has a fascinating character arc, where you really get a look at someone who suffered under the Shah, but then also had sort of realization of what had happened after the revolution. And so her character arc, I think, in a way parallels Niloufar's on the American side, where Nazanin is also sort of following out, carrying out orders and following what she's being told. But that doesn't mean that these characters aren't questioning the things that are happening on the ground, and they're not changing as those things are happening on the ground. So, you know, talking about Niloufar, and sort of her growth, her character's growth throughout the story, she has these really interesting quotes and these really interesting sort of ideas, as if like she's reflecting the reader's thoughts about the political situation. And she has one quote where she's talking about the hostage crisis, and you know, she's just really almost, you know, disparaging the Islamic Republic, because she says they're creating this crisis, they're prolonging it, and then, you know, now they want to end it when it's not useful to them anymore. And it made me think of our current political situation, to where, you know, we're sort of in a crisis with Iran of in arguably of our own making, by quitting the deal and putting us on a path to conflict. And now here the United States is presenting a case to the UN to try and curtail the very problem that we created. So, you know, I wondered when you were writing it, like, A, what do you think about the parallel of that kind of an idea, how that's what happened with the hostage crisis, how the Islamic Republic created that crisis for themselves. Do you see a parallel in the crisis that we have now? And was there sort of an intentional, what are they called, Easter eggs, you know, these sort of intentional places where you were making a political commentary that was almost meant to reflect certain parallels?
We were very deliberate. This is not an analysis of U.S.-Iran relations. This is not an article. I mean, one of the things that we had to do when Ambassador Grossman and I were writing the book is we had to constantly make sure that this did not sound like a State Department briefing memo.
It certainly does not.
No, but it was difficult, because
sounds like a thriller.
Between us, we have about 65 years of experience of doing exactly, of writing exactly those kinds of things, you know, which are sort of on the one hand this, on the other hand that, and, you know, this is this, and certain kinds of language that you use. So we must have gone through about 14 or 15 different versions of the manuscript, and one of the major tasks that we set ourselves was to get rid of that kind of language. The other was to make it so that you would read this and you couldn't tell what I had written and what Ambassador Grossman had written. We wanted it to be uniform. For example, someone said, "Well, did you do the Iran part and did he do the Washington part?" I said, "No, we both did both." We basically traded chapters back and forth, worked on each other's language, projected it on the screen with using a computer, and went through it line by line. You don't get everything, obviously. There are things even today I look at it and I say, oh my gosh, we should have said it a different way. But that was the idea. But this is not a political essay. Obviously, there's a lot of politics in it because it's history. I mean, there's history and politics in it, and because it involves a situation that affects a lot of people today, and a lot of people care about these things very much. But it is not, you know, our goal was, let's tell a good story.
Well, it's a good story. You certainly did that.
Oh, thank you.
It's I think it's funny. It's interesting that you bring up memos and all of this, because there's actually a lot of talk in the book also about the education of American diplomats, not just sort of the internal training at the State Department, but also at international relations programs in Washington, D.C. And there's this line that was in the prologue, and immediately I was like, it's a little bit of a jab, about Niloufer teaching her undergraduates a humane version of international relations, completely different from her own bitter experience. And I think I have some strong ideas about this because I'm a graduate of Georgetown's School of Foreign Service.
Okay.
But I was kind of curious. I mean, do you feel like there are aspects of the education that is missing for diplomats, either, you know, at these big IR schools or even internally, and particularly when it comes to countries like Iran that we don't have relations with?
Well, again, this is really, you know, it's interesting you saw that. I think I mentioned it also when I talk about her entering foreign service class and how a lot of them had studied either at Georgetown or SAIS. Or Fletcher, I think some others had been to Fletcher, and I call international relations a nebulous subject. I think I called it a nebulous subject. Maybe that's probably my own prejudice. I'm trained as a historian.
Yay!
And so, you know, every time anyone asks me a question, I always say, let's go back to the beginning. And then, so you end up back at the time of Cyrus the Great or the Old Testament or some such thing, or the Greeks or whatever it is, whenever it is. But it's, you know, it, one thing is clear, and it does come out in the book, I must say, again, our best attempts to fictionalize it, but you can't help putting your own views in there. And I'm glad you noticed this, is that the lack of a knowledge of history has led, or a distorted view of history has led both sides into some very negative territory. Somebody once said, Americans have forgotten all of their history, and Iranians haven't forgotten any of their history.
That was the perfect
fun fact.
Perfect. That was perfect.
Yeah, I really like that line that Americans have forgotten all their history, and Iranians just, you know, sort of refuse to forget any of it. And the nod to history, I'm also a trained historian, which is why, funny enough, when I've done lectures for our foreign service officers about, you know, they ask me, hey, in an hour and a half, can you do an overview of Iran?
Sure.
For our foreign service officers.
Right.
And I always say, sure, you know, I can take my best stab at thousands of years of history in an hour and a half. But I always jokingly say, I'm like, I can't start contemporary Iran without, you know, going back at least 500 years. I'm like, it's just, and that's my ongoing joke. I'm like, I understand that this is supposed to be a very brief version, but you really can't understand the context of today unless you go back, you know, honestly, several centuries and understand how we get to the place we get to today. So
sure.
I really appreciated that sort of nod to the significance of historical context in understanding.
Well, I do talk about, you know, in the context of the story, I try to get this idea that, you know, how this affected Niloufar and how this affected Rusbe, growing up in these Iranian American families where the older generation talked about these things all the time.
Me and Mona can relate to
kind of Dai John Napoleon sort of things. I mean, they were just, you know, they never stopped arguing, you know, who was responsible for this? What did the British do? What did the Russians do? What did Mossadegh do? What did the Shah do? And so forth and so on. And I see this in my own family, and for most of the next generation, they don't care much about this. You know, these are the older generation, and they're obsessed with this thing. But I put it in deliberately that in fact for someone like Niloufar or Rusbe, they were fascinated, and they said, you know, there's something really really interesting here. The other part that you might have noticed was when the two of them become so disillusioned after Halabja, and Rusbe says, you know, maybe our parents were right about all of these things they said. We thought they were delusional when they talked about conspiracies and how the world was out to get us, Iranians. But just maybe they were, maybe there was something there. It's sort of key. They both kind of end up sort of reconsidering the assumptions that they'd always lived with.
That particular part of the book, I think, at least for me, where the attack is being described is very heavy. And it's very, you know, I mean, it's incredibly well written because it's so hard to read, because it's, you know, the way that that history is painted is also, so you really feel what the characters are feeling. So you can understand why they sort of have this moment of reckoning with their own roles in how things have played out the way they've played out, and why, you know, again, I don't want to give away too much, but why they start, to your point, questioning things in terms of how their parents had thought about events and how their parents had sort of taught them things, and they're questioning assumptions. I think for me personally, it felt like I could identify at least with the characters where, you know, to your point, I felt like I was always getting a history lesson from my family. Like, we weren't talking about,
right.
we weren't talking about normal things. It was just a history lesson constantly.
That's right. And the funny thing is, the people who are doing this are not people didn't study history as an academic subject. I mean, the people who really who talked about the history were engineers, doctors, you know, heart surgeons, economists. But everyone talked about history.
Yeah.
All the time. But
I just want to throw in, I think,
as an academic subject, it had no standing. When I told people that I studied history, people would look at me and said, oh, not medicine, not engineering. You know, what are you going to do with that?
Like the most traditionally Persian parent thing to say.
Indeed it is. But at the same time, everybody is concerned with it, and everyone has a version of it. And it comes out. But the thing about the interesting part about Halabja is we did do some serious research there, including with the Kurdistan regional office in Washington, which every year in March puts on an event to mark the anniversary of what happened, the events at Halabja. For example, the incident of the baby that is adopted, that happened. These children, there were a group of children who were brought to Iran and were adopted by Iranian parents, raised as Iranians, and then later on I think using, in many cases, DNA testing, were able to find their original relatives. But to all intents and purposes, they were Iranian. I met some of them at these events, and it's very moving, very very moving experience. So you know that you see these things and you want to work them in. But I'm very pleased, you know, because I'm very concerned about the reaction of Iranians to this book.
I mean, honestly, that was sort of my next question. But I wanted to preface it with saying that the book even opened with a lot of love both for Americans and Iranians. You dedicate it to FSOs, but then also noted, you know, we also want to honor Iranians who have endured loss. And so I guess my question is, what kind of takeaways do you hope Americans, maybe with less knowledge about Iran, will have? And what takeaways do you hope the Iranians will have, either the Iranian-Americans or Irans in Iran?
I really don't. That's I'm waiting to find out.
Fair.
The second question. Takeaway again. This is not written as a polemic or as a historical, you know, as a bit of history or politics. I've done that kind of writing, but this is different. This is a good story, and I want people to say, couldn't put it down. Love the characters. Love this. Like that. And that would be fine enough for me. As far as the Iranians, I mean, my question is, you know, I hope I haven't misread the culture. I have, you know, misread people, misread things, or, you know, portrayed things in a negative way. I suspect that there will be some people who will not like this book at all.
That's okay. Everyone's going to have an opinion.
That's what you have. I do not want to be. On the other hand, I do not want to be Salman Rushdie.
I mean, do you think this is something that would ever be translated into Persian?
That's a good question. I have no objection to it. I think it would be fun to do, but. To the best of my knowledge, my best guess would be that the authorities in Tehran might have difficulty authorizing it.
That's fair. I guess they'll have to wait for
an underground. There could be an underground.
That's right. I was going to say they're just going to have to wait for the pirated dubbed movie version of this.
That's right. who plays Niloufar in the movie? That's what I've always wanted.
You know, we have some pretty good actors among, you know, NIAC membership, so I'm sure we can help tap somebody.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, sorry, I was just going to say...
Go ahead.
To your point, that Ambassador Limbert you made earlier, it's... I think if people can treat the novel for what it is, a fictional tale, right? Like, it's meant to be... Its intention is to... take these things that have happened, but turn it into something entertaining and fun to read. Like that's really the objective, while also providing some nuance in these characters that reveal things about these politics and this history and this culture. And I think to that it's really accomplished that. You know, you talk about the sensitivities to Iranian culture, and there were times in reading it, the descriptions of Tehran, you know, the something as simple as reading, you know, the box of Shirini Danmarki, like the Denmark pastries. And
Do you remember that place?
Absolutely. And so that's why I identified with so much of it as I read it, and it really brought out the sort of nostalgia. So I wanted to, and just the interactions with the families and the conversations, I thought it was it was not just a clear effort, but a success in showing the intricacies of that culture and really describing a sort of nostalgic picture for someone who has visited Tehran and is familiar with it. Yes, it was very, very familiar. It didn't feel like you were reading something, you know, it felt like you were reading something that clearly someone who was familiar with it was writing, and almost not writing it from an outside perspective.
I mean, so what I'll add is that I think the nostalgia it brought up, because I'm in D.C. and I've lived here for 5 years, you know, descriptions of Georgetown and M Street to me were as nostalgic as the descriptions of, you know, the kebabis in Tehran.
Right.
And so, you know, I think both the authors, I mean, you and Master Grossman really, truly handled this with a lot of love, and care. And I think it really, really comes across.
You notice there's a lot about food in there, too.
Yes.
Which yes. is very appropriate for the culture. That's why.
That's right.
I was like, oh, there's got to be a lot of food in there. Yeah. And, you know, actually, now thinking about it, I didn't think about it when I was reading it, the fact that there's two authors that are writing this, and you would think that there's two voices. But that's actually a testament to how well your two voices were fused, that it didn't even occur to me in reading it that this is a co-authored novel.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, you can read, for example, the book that Bill Clinton co-authored with James Patterson a few years ago, and it's very clear who wrote what. First of all, Bill Clinton is a much better writer than his co-author. One of the things we did deliberately is and was cut down a lot of the political descriptions. You know, the earlier versions had a lot more describing the politics of post-revolutionary Iran, where you have all these competing, where you have these competing groups, you know, competing for power. Very early on, we decided, no, this does not belong in a novel. You know, and so we cut down. I think we probably cut some of these descriptions by like about 80%.
I have one last kind of burning question that might be a little bit silly, but did you ever watch Argo?
Of course.
What did you think?
Argo was it was like our book. It's historical fiction based on real events. Now, the real Argo, the book that the late Tony Mendez wrote, that's nonfiction. I mean, that was an account of what happened. But it was lousy Hollywood.
Well, like you said, they've got to make it sell, right?
That's right. I mean, we're not going to get rich on this book. I mean, unless lightning strikes somehow, but we're not. Somebody said, if you're going to be a writer, keep your day job is what they advised us.
That's totally valid.
But I saw Argo, and I was thinking about it because they constructed scenes in there that never happened, like that whole business at the airport. Well, maybe that I don't know if Argo inspired the scene where we put Niloufar at the airport during the escape of those Canadian Six. Of the Six. Mm-hmm. We have her there. We have her located there. Was that inspired by Argo? I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But I liked Argo because it was a great story. You know, the movie, it was a great story. You knew how it ended. It was still exciting. And the characters, the Hollywood characters, particularly Alan Arkin, I thought, and that were just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, go ahead. Sorry,
my last comment was just going to be, it's funny that you brought up like a Hollywood version, because as I was reading this, I don't know if you know the show The Americans, which is basically about two Soviet spies who pose as an American couple, an American family. And in my mind, as I was reading this, I just kept thinking, oh, my God, this is like The Iranians. You can make an entire show out of this novel and the reverse placement of Iranian Americans in Iran, posing as like Iranians from Iran.
Oh, they were wonderful. Oh, they were wonderful. That was a wonderful show.
Yeah.
I agree. I love that. I love that. Did that come from a novel originally or something?
I actually don't know if it came from a novel.
Or was it original? An original screenplay. I'm not sure. But the other one, Homeland.
That's right.
That came from, I think, an Israeli TV series.
Yeah, that was based on an Israeli TV series.
As an Israeli TV series, and then got transferred into U.S. So anyway, think about who should play Porter, who should play Niloufar. Niloufar.
Mm. All right. So hopefully that's a 2021 movie that we're all going to be catching. We'll do some sort of screening. Well, Ambassador Lindbergh, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the book or any messages to our listeners?
I would say only enjoy the book. You know, I hope you enjoy reading the book as much as my co-author and I enjoyed writing it. We had a good time writing it. The first reactions from friends are either doing a lot of taaruf, or but they've been very nice, and we've been very, very gratified, because you don't know. You don't know when you write something like this. Neither of us are experienced novelists. This is a first for both of us. So you don't know if is this complete dreck, or is it worthwhile. So the reactions we've had so far have been very positive and very gratifying. But do remember, please, it is a work of fiction.
And that's really fair.
It is a work of fiction. The incidents, many of the incidents, most of the incidents in here did not happen as they were written. Now, having said it's work of fiction, you obviously will recognize many of the people in it, some by their real names and some by other name, some going by other names. But remember, it's fiction, and in a way, that's for a historian, that's refreshing. To be able to write fiction, you don't have to worry about, you know, no footnotes, and you don't have to worry, you know, is it this day? Did it happen on this day, or did it happen on that day? And did X do this, or did Y do that? And what did they say? What did they say? And if somebody says, "Well, you got this wrong," I said, "This is fiction." Doesn't matter.
I like that. That's a good coverall for everything. Well, thank you again for joining us, Ambassador Lindbergh. We will make sure to put a link to publish the book, Believers, in the podcast description. And we look forward to Ambassador Lindbergh having you back on. And also, we'd love to hear from all of you who have read the book. And if you have anything to say, please feel free to shoot an email over to NIAC. And we will catch you next time.
I would very much like to see comments, particularly from Iranian friends. I mean, their reaction to the book, I think, is very important. It's very important. I very much look forward to seeing those comments.
So send those comments, everybody, to podcast@niacouncil.org, and Ambassador Lindbergh will make sure to forward those on to you as well.
Please do. Please do.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, Ambassador Lindbergh.
Thank you, Asal. Thank you, Manav. Nice talking to both of you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.